This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in May.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Can America's political crisis be fixed? Can an Enlightenment-era institution, liberal democracy, survive and thrive in a post-Enlightenment world? If for some, salvaging the older sources of national solidarity is neither possible sociologically nor desirable politically or ethically, what cultural resources will support liberal democracy in the future? Today we're going to be talking with James Davison Hunter about his new book, Democracy and Solidarity on the Cultural Roots of America's Political Crisis. James Davison Hunter is LaRosse Levinson Distinguished Professor of Religion, Culture, and Social Theory and Executive Director of the Institution for Advanced Studies in Culture at the University of Virginia. Previous books include Culture Wars and Science and the Good. James Davison Hunter, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
So you famously, I'm going to coin the term, pointed out culture wars some 30 years ago. I wonder what the connection is here. Is it fraying over time, worsening of those culture wars? You're focusing here on the cultural aspects instead of just the political here.
Yeah, well, first of all, culture wars argument, which I introduced 30 years ago, I'd like to be able to claim credit for that, but it actually goes to Otto von Bismarck, who named it in Germany at the time of German unification. And it's remarkable what the similarities are between that moment in history and our own. It is about the struggle to define America. What America has been, what America is, and where America is going in the future. And this book is really the bookend to culture wars, again, three decades ago. But rather than focusing on polarization, which was really the heart of the argument, the nature of polarization in our politics, this book is really looking at the other side of the coin. Rather than playing off of the national motto, rather than looking at the pluribus, the wide array of differences and how those differences have created conflict, I'm looking at the sources of unity. Is there anything left? What has happened to the glue that used to bind us together? So that's really, it's a continuation of the argument of culture wars, but looking at it from a very different angle.
You write, for quite some time, the culture that has underwritten liberal democracy in America and in Europe, too, has been unraveling. The cultural sources that made it possible in the first place have, in the most elemental ways, dissolved. All of the efforts to reconfigure and revivify those cultural sources over the decades have failed. You talk about, and it's in the title, solidarity. What do you mean by solidarity?
Well, every institution, whether it's a family, a church, or synagogue, or it's a corporation, or even a nation, every institution has to have something that binds them together. And otherwise, a family would be ungovernable. A church would be ungovernable, and so on. So solidarity is built, the need for solidarity, the need for a cohesion is necessary for social life, for human societies. And, but I don't use the word consensus. I use the word solidarity. The word consensus suggests that what we need is rational agreement on a whole range of issues or a whole range of understandings conceptions of the world. But really what we need is something like solidarity. Solidarity speaks to the more emotional or social dimensions of our binding, of what holds us together. I mean, think of it this way. We may disagree with our neighbors, but if an intruder comes into our neighborhood who's trying to steal, break into houses and steal, we're going to come together that there's a sense that we have something at stake together. Even if we, apart from our disagreements, we share common hopes, we share common fears, we share common desires. So it's not just about rational agreement. It is about anything that binds us together. In this book, trace the sources of solidarity not just to the conscious elements of that adhesive, but to the unspoken, the implicit agreements that have long bound the country together in spite of our disagreements. These are the agreements that contain our more explicit disagreements.
In the book, you go into history, how we got here, how we might go forward successfully from here. I want to pause right now, just to concentrate on your first sentence in the book, "Democracy in America is in crisis." I think many of us would nod our heads along with that. But you contrast that with, I remember Congressman Crenshaw in many people responding January 6th, for example. So that's just pearl clutching. We'll be fine. So democracy in America in crisis. You've said it there in the first sentence.
Yeah. Well, I don't think, and I think for most people, the crisis of contemporary American democracy is apparent to everyone. I think it's sure. I mean, in American history, there has always been conflict. There have been times of political instability. In the middle of the 19th century, democracy was in effect suspended in order to have a civil war, the bloodiest war in our history. I would say that the crisis of democracy today is rooted in the ways, or at least is most visible in the ways in which our government has become dysfunctional, its inability to get things done, to work through problems between the right and the left. It is manifest in the breaking of a social contract. There has been a long-standing and long-building legitimation crisis in American politics, in which half of the country views the other side as illegitimate, and that's when one side is in power. When the other side is in power, the other side views the other party as completely illegitimate, and its claim to power as illegitimate. We're in a situation in which, I mean, I would say, for example, that in a post-truth world, democracy is a contradiction in terms. You can't run a government without some agreements on what is real, what is not real, what's true, what's not true. Fundamental understandings of the world are contested, and it's very hard to have a functioning and vital government and a functional and vital democracy in that context.
So if we don't have democracy, then I guess it's some form of authoritarian government? That if we can't rescue this, then it's authoritarianism coming to America?
Well, I think this is, again, not just an American problem. We're seeing some of this in European democracies as well. If, remember, again, it's that some kind of unification, some kind of cohesion is required in any human society, and certainly within its politics. And if a society can't generate solidarity or cohesion organically, naturally, it will be imposed coercively. It will be imposed from the top down. Because, again, societies can't function this way. Institutions can't function this way. So there's very clearly an authoritarian impulse that I don't think we are in an authoritarian government right now, but you can see the preconditions of authoritarian government being formed. And it's again, I'm not concerned about it in the immediate future, but the signs are there.
So let's go back a little bit, and you tell us how we got here. So let's go back to the, again, we're talking with James Davison Hunter. The book is called Democracy and Solidarity. Very interesting book, out and available now. And you can find James Davison Hunter at jamesdavisonhunter.com. So you talk about the founding of American democracy in an atmosphere and in a heritage you call hybrid enlightenment. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, democracy in America, and democracy generally, is rooted in a vision of human flourishing. It is an ethical ideal for which politics is its means to achieve. So democracy is not just a set of institutions. It's not just a set of rituals and practices that we do every 2 years or every 4 years. It is those things. But what underwrites it, is a vision, an ethical vision, about the betterment of all human beings. This was an extraordinary revolution in the 18th century. And it was rooted, that ethical vision was rooted in an intellectual revolution called the Enlightenment. But the Enlightenment looked different in France than it did in England and Scotland, than it did in Germany, and it looked different still in the United States. In America, it was a hybrid Enlightenment. Think of it as a reservoir that was fed by multiple streams. One stream being the revival of classical republicanism. Another stream came from what I would call Lockean individualism. And yet another stream came from Calvinism, conservative Protestant Christianity. And they all blended together. It was a hybrid of these things. And it was out of that that ethical vision came into being. So you have, for example, someone like Jefferson and Adams. Adams coming from a more Calvinist New England, Jefferson, a deist, coming from aristocratic Virginia. The differences are famous and very well known. There are arguments. And personal animosity is very well known, but they shared certain assumptions about the nature of this historical moment that they were living in. They saw the opportunity to build something new and different. Novos seclorum, a new order of the ages, as they said back then. For all their differences, they came together and crafted a form of government that would be fundamentally different from the kind of monarchical, largely authoritarian regimes of early modern and ancient Europe. And so what bound them together was this hybrid Enlightenment. And again, they forged a politics that would reflect that ethical vision.
You talk about this hybrid enlightenment gave the nation a framework for what you call working through our differences. That's a very specific term, working through. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So the problem with the hybrid enlightenment was that it contained certain, from the very beginning, it contained certain contradictions. And these contradictions were socially and politically explosive. These contradictions are summed up by the promise of freedom to all men, but the denial of that freedom to large swaths of the American population, the promise of equality, but then the denial of that equality to large swaths of the American people. So, and the promise of toleration, and yet great intolerance. I mean, one thinks of the intolerance toward Mormonism in the middle of the 19th century. These were contradictions, and these contradictions, again, were inherently incendiary. They created conflict. The most important one, of course, is the contradiction of promising freedom and equality and yet denying that in the most grotesque ways to Black humanity. So this notion that, but part of the amazing thing about democracy is that it creates the conditions. How I want to put it. I would put it this way. It embodies the principle of the resistance to government within the principle of government itself. That's a line from from Reinhold Niebuhr. It contains the principle of resistance to government within government itself. So the working through of these contradictions, when it was successful, it ultimately created and expanded freedom for Mormons, Roman Catholics, for Jews, for Asians, for the Chinese, and ultimately for Black Americans as well. And obviously, this process of working through the struggle toward a greater inclusivity, a greater tolerance, a greater equality is imperfect. We're still struggling in these ways, and over older issues. We're still struggling for those things, and yet we have seen progress as well. There are obviously greater freedoms for Jews, Roman Catholics, Mormons, and so on. But this is the very nature of democracy. It's aspirational, and we are continuing to work through those contradictions. And I think part of the story of our moment today is that it's a struggle over the boundaries of who is included and who is not, of what views are acceptable and what views are not. Many conservative Christians believed that they are being marginalized from the political mainstream, that their voices are being suppressed. And that's part of the resentment that we see. But of course, many other groups do as well. So I think I would describe it's a bit of an academic term, but I would say that the culture war really is comprised of two hegemonic projects. These are projects to determine who will be an authority, what are the legitimate boundaries of inclusion and exclusion. Who's in and who's out? And we're not finding any common ground there at all.
Let's take a brief break. We'll come back with much more with James Davison Hunter. The book is Democracy and Solidarity on the Cultural Roots of America's Political Crisis. That's out and available now. And you can find James Davison Hunter at his website, jamesdavisonhunter.com. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Professor James Davison Hunter. His new book is Democracy and Solidarity. It's out and available now. James Davison Hunter is LaBrosse Levinson Distinguished Professor of Religion, Culture, and Social Theory and Executive Director of the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture at the University of Virginia. His previous books include Culture Wars and Science and the Good. So, Professor Hunter, I want to do a little bit more history before we take this to present and future.
Sure.
So we talked about how American democracy started with this hybrid enlightenment. That was the atmosphere. It gave us a framework for working through our differences. And one of those, I guess, cultural glues or cultural things that that bound us and allowed us, helped us to work through very, very serious problems, you know, including slavery, and that you pointed out that contradiction: all men are free, but we have slaves. One of those, I guess, cultural things that bound us was a common religious heritage. Abraham Lincoln, you point out, said both Union and Confederacy read from the same Bible, prayed to the same God. Over time, that frayed, right? That separated out.
Yes, sure. Yeah, right. I mean, again, this was part of the oversized influence of conservative Christianity in the founding of the Republic. There have been debates for a long, long time. They're pretty boring debates, but the debate is between, well, is America, was it founded as a secular nation or was it founded as a Christian nation? And the fact of the matter is that because of the hybrid enlightenment and because it drew from multiple sources, cultural and philosophical sources, it was both at the same time. But part of the reason for the success of Christianity, at least in its influence, was the fact that it was made up of so much of American Christianity was defined by the dissidents who left England to find religious freedom. Obviously, there were Episcopalians and so on, but Calvinism was institutionalized not just among the intellectual classes during the colonial period, and even at the time of the founding, but it was also institutionalized within Middle America itself through the expansion of churches and the ways in which churches became the foundations for what became public schools. So religion permeated. Yes, there were differences between Methodists and Episcopalians, Congregationalists and Baptists and the like, but there was nevertheless a common Christianity that bound people together. This is unlike the deism of, say, someone like Franklin or Jefferson or Thomas Paine. That secular worldview was largely institutionalized among elites, not all, but many of the elites of that day, and it never percolated into the common worldview of ordinary Americans. And you see this in the fact that of the 180 or so colleges that were founded before the Civil War, all but two were religious in nature. So Calvinism conservative Christianity more broadly was probably the dominant influence through the early part of the 19th century, and its influence continued right through the 19th century into the early part of the 20th century, and then things began to change.
I'll bring things forward, I guess, to today. I'll quote you. American public life is divided, and you made reference to this earlier on, American public life is divided not only in its vocabulary, but in its premises about what is real and true and how we know these things, about what is right and just, and about what the nation is and about what it should be. And in fact, some proudly say they're nihilists, right? That's kind of what the tendency is, not even seeking consensus, and in fact, the total opposite. You also say without some larger cultural consensus, civic life collapses. And I think we're certainly seeing that. Do you see this just continuing?
Well, sadly, I do. I think that there are, and this is a really important point to make, there are millions and millions of Americans who would like to see the polarization stop, who would be committed and are committed to the rebuilding of civil society, to recreating some normalcy. The problem is that our public discourse is so polarized, and polarized in part because of the communications technologies that drive public discourse. You contrast, for example, the Lincoln-Douglas debates of the mid-19th century, where Stephen Douglas would stand up and speak for an hour, maybe an hour and a half, in front of a live audience where there's genuine accountability. People are booing or they're cheering. Lincoln would stand up and then give a response that would last an hour, again, in front of an audience where people are responding and there's genuine accountability. Our presidential debates in the most powerful nation of the world, in a contest for the leadership of that of our country, they are given 2 minutes to respond to some of the most important and divisive issues of our time, and then 30 seconds as a response. And the very nature of that discourse is going to mean a certain shallowness in how we deal with each other. It's going to be a discourse that looks for one-liners, that tries to reduce complex issues into aphorisms or cliches and zingers, kind of gotcha moment. It's a parody of democracy. It's not the real thing. So I think that's part of the problem right now. And if we're to look for the renewal of democracy, it seems to me that we have to be thinking much more seriously. We have a leadership class right now that, I mean, I would say especially in politics, and it's not uniform, but by and large, our leadership class is pretty second rate. They look for celebrity. They're not well educated. They're not thoughtful. They don't provide nuance. They oftentimes lead polarization rather than seek amelioration or compromise. So we have a problem of leadership. That's certainly one of the problems. And I think most of the best and brightest who would seek office want no part of the political culture of Washington, D.C. and of the nation as a whole.
How do you solve that problem? It seems like the incentives to run for office are just so perverse these days. It's you know, who top-tier leaders, why in the world would you want to run?
Well, exactly. I mean, I remember the time when people like Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, experienced, practiced leaders, thoughtful, educated, well-informed. I mean, they could have stepped into leadership, it seems to me. But when they saw what the current system does to people and what it does to their families, I mean, they're smart, and they don't want to do this. Again, as you, I think you're exactly right. The incentives are not there. I have a friend who was who was a former governor and was offered a Senate seat to run for a Senate seat, and it probably would have won pretty handily. But he spent about 2 or 3 months doing the due diligence, going to Washington, talking to people, and he said, "Look, this is a destructive process. This is not a process, and there's just very few people to work with to rebuild. So I don't know how you change the incentive structures. I think oftentimes the bravest and the best, the most courageous of our leaders." Simply absent themselves from the process because it is so dehumanizing and destructive.
Before we go to another break, I want to, I guess, take us to a darker place, and then after the break, talk about some solutions. You do talk okay. about some of these. So earlier you said, you know, democracy is in crisis. You said something to the effect of you're not worried about immediate end to American democracy, but the trend is bad, right? And so, somewhere out in the future, if we don't do something, so looking at the dark side, how would that happen? Do you think this great democratic experiment, how would that come to an end?
Well, let me think about it for a little bit. Russia claims to be a democracy. Iran claims to be a democracy. One can have the form of democracy without its substance. And I think that's probably the path that this unwinding will take. We will have the form of democracy. We will continue to have elections. We will continue. But it will be a parody of democracy's highest ideals. Again, and I think the illustration of our public discourse, yes, we now have two presidential candidates. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. The likelihood that Biden and Trump will likely be the presidential contenders. These are two people that almost no one wants. But that somehow the system has put them forward, go through the motions of presidential debates. But it will mostly be a shouting match. It will mostly be about not serious and substantive discussion about important policy issues. It will be a parody. It will be about building tribes, manipulating. I don't think the American public is more stupid than it's been in the past. It's just that the larger public culture just gives us no other options. We have a discourse that's often driven by algorithms, and it's just very hard to transcend that. And you can't do that without again, strong leadership moving in a different direction.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with more with James Davison Hunter. The book is Democracy and Solidarity. That's out and available now. We'll have more following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with James Davison Hunter. He is LaBrosse Levinson Distinguished Professor of Religion, Culture, and Social Theory, and Executive Director of the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture at the University of Virginia. Previous books have included Culture Wars and Science and the Good. Current book out now is called Democracy and Solidarity on the Cultural Roots of America's Political Crisis. So, Professor Hunter, before we get into some solutions and take a more hopeful direction at the end of the conversation here,
yeah.
You point out in the book we're at a point of exhaustion now. You know, democracy in crisis and just exhausted. I think many of us can feel that. That's manifesting itself to me, at least anecdotally here, with my progressive friends. And what they're telling me is they've felt like democracy is in crisis in the age of Trump, and they've kind of been on guard, and they're just exhausted. Some of them are telling me they're just wanting to check out, which I tell them that's fatal, that's disastrous. How do we get people to stop from checking out?
Well, that's a really good question, and it is. I think it really. Your anecdotes really point to a central part of the problem. Our political culture is fundamentally dehumanizing. I argue in the book that at the end of the day, the enemy is not the other side. It's the nihilism. It's the nihilism that permeates our larger political culture. The ways in which we denigrate our neighbors, we denigrate and diminish our opponents. We no longer see them as the loyal opposition, but as enemies. And oftentimes, at least in the extremes, they act that way. And people think it's just, how do you make progress? When people won't listen, when people won't engage reasonably, what's the point? What's the point? They give up. They don't have a stomach, in a way, for working, doing the hard work of engaging each other through our differences. And that's the nature of democracy. Democracy is fundamentally an agreement not to kill each other over our differences, but rather to talk them through, which is part of the reason why I spend so much time on public discourse. We agree not to kill each other over our differences, but rather to talk them through, and people are giving up on that. So the exhaustion is certainly psychological and emotional, as you've pointed out with your anecdote, with your friends, but it's also a cultural exhaustion. They're just the resources, the cultural resources of hope, for example, the cultural resources that will help us to find truth. The cultural resources that would lead us to ethical agreements over these very tough issues, those resources have largely been diminished. We no longer know how to talk through these things in ways that are appropriate to the complexity of these issues. So there is an exhaustion that's both cultural and deeply personal and psychological, and as you said, it's disastrous for democracy. People, on the one hand, people just want to check out. On the other hand, you find people who want to just burn it all down. Think that the only way forward is to start over again and just burn it all down, and you see that kind of anarchistic. A theme on both the left and the right in the extremes. So, and that wasn't there 30 years ago. But anyway, yeah, so it's the common problem is the nihilism, the dehumanization that that characterizes our political culture. And again, unless you can draw from deeper sources, thicken, if you will, our political culture and the resources that that would revivify an ethical vision of freedom, equality, toleration in a world that's infinitely more complex today than it was at the time of the founding. Unless we can do that, we're not going to make too much progress.
We have about 3 or so minutes left in the conversation. I do want to end this on a hopeful note. Give us some solutions. How do we, what are some scenarios in which we revivify a democracy in America?
Well, I'm in W.E.B. Du Bois spoke in the early part of the 20th century in his studies of the Civil War and Reconstruction. And Civil War scholars since then, I'm thinking of, there are many, many people, but I'm thinking of Eric Foner in particular, came to regard Reconstruction, an important word. It was the reconstruction of the nation after the bloodiest war in our history. They came to see this as a second founding. And I believe that we're at a moment where we need to start taking seriously the possibility of a third founding. And at the heart of that, of the second founding, was a renewed living into the ethical vision of a society that was inclusively free, inclusively equal, inclusively tolerant. I think that through hard work, we can get there. But right now, again, against this backdrop of exhaustion, we're not going to get there. Because it does require hard work. But I do think we're at a moment where we might need to reconsider the possibility of a third founding. That third founding would be rooted in a renewed vision for the flourishing of all human beings. It would be, and politics would be the instruments by which that ethical vision would come into being. But you can't do it without a thoughtful, virtuous citizenship, and you certainly can't do it without a competent, thoughtful, well-educated leadership. And you can't do it as well without a revivification of civil society, the mediating institutions between individuals and the state. Right now, our mediating institutions, whether it's higher education, oftentimes it's churches, professional organizations, and so on, civil society has become so politicized, they become essentially arms of political parties. They're not functioning then as civil institutions if they are simply politicized in these ways. Obviously, we're seeing this in higher education all the time, but it's certainly a flashpoint. But it's time to depoliticize civil society. And so we're not going to be able to do it without a renewed and virtuous citizenship, a new class and quality of leadership, and without civil institutions that are committed to doing the work of civil society, which is to educate the public, to provide a context where democratic practice, whether it's local or national, can find its feet.
Well, we'll leave it there. A good place to end the discussion. The book is Democracy and Solidarity on the Cultural Roots of America's Political Crisis. And we've had as our guest James Davison Hunter, who's LaBrosse Levinson Distinguished Professor of Religion, Culture, and Social Theory and Executive Director of the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture at the University of Virginia. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Every rural person and place has a story. Change is part of that story. Rural Utah at a Crossroads is part of the Smithsonian Traveling Exhibit Crossroads, Change in Rural America, which explores the changing meaning of rural life and identity. Utah Humanities is touring Crossroads to 8 rural communities across Utah in 2024. As part of the tour, Utah Humanities and Utah Public Radio are partnering with exhibition hosts to interview local residents about change in their communities. This interview with Suresh Kulkarni was recorded at the Brigham City Museum of Art and History.
I'm from a very big city in India called Hyderabad, but at that time it was 3 million, and I was born in 1944. To a highly educated family. My father and mother were both professors at the university. My path was laid out by my parents. They told me that I was going to be an engineer. They said, you're going to get a PhD from the U.S. Well, not really. They really didn't want me to go to the U.S. right away. They wanted me to get some practical training in India, get married, and then go to the U.S. for training. I was able to get around my parents. Mm-hmm. I was able to get a scholarship at the University of Denver. I came here and did my PhD in 3 years. And then I went back, and unfortunately, I couldn't find a job because I was overqualified. I saw this little ad in the local newspaper there in Denver, and it said, Thiokol is hiring. And I had no idea where Thiokol was or where Brigham City was. So I applied, and they told me to come out for an interview. So I came out for the interview, and that was 1971. And here I was on the plane looking at a map and trying to figure out where to go. And so fortunately, at that time, right next to me, was one of the apostles of the Mormon church, Boyd Packer. Okay, so he was next to me, and he says, where are you trying to go? And he says, I'm trying to find Brigham City on the map, and I don't know where it is. And he said, well, why don't you get your car rented and just follow me, okay? And so I got the car from Hertz and followed him and came to Brigham City. Next morning, I got up and I called the HR guy at the plant. And I said, okay, how do I get there? And he said, well, why don't you take the road that goes west? There is only one road. And you keep driving. And when you feel like you have reached the end of the earth, you drive one more mile. So that was my first exposure to Thiokol out there. So we joined the company. And then I started out as a design engineer and then rose up through the ranks. And then finally, in 1989, I was promoted to the vice president of engineering. So I had about 558. So I was the top guy reporting to the general manager. There were two of us at Thiokol who were not U.S. citizens. I was from India, and there was another guy from England. Okay, there was only two of us. And Reagan edicted that if you want to work on defense projects in the U.S., you had to be a U.S. citizen. Okay. And so either lose the job or become a U.S. citizen, right? So that was in the late 80s. But the day I took the oath, when you take that oath and you have to cut all ties to India, and that was hard, you know? It's kind of like breaking your umbilical cord, you know? You just say, oh, okay, I'm done, okay, when you take that oath. It was quite a change to come from a place that was extremely open to come to a place where on Sunday, because we were not the Mormons, to find the place was essentially closed up. I really think that it's going to get more cosmopolitan, mainly because the company is growing, okay? They have already advertised that they're going to have a big investment here, which is going to create 1,000 more jobs. So it is definitely going to attract more people. I think as far as the community goes, there will be more acceptance of people coming from outside, and it's going to grow as more forgiving, more accommodating, okay? More acceptance of different cultures. Okay? So hopefully it'll be good.
Rural Utah at a Crossroads is produced by Maya Shumway. It is a collaboration between Utah Public Radio, Utah Humanities, and the community hosts of Crossroads, Change in Rural America, a Smithsonian Museum on Main Street exhibition made possible in the Beehive State by Utah Humanities. Support for Museum on Main Street has been provided by the United States Congress. Broadcasts of rural Utah at a crossroads on UPR is supported by our members,